Today is Monday, August 28th, 2006. My name is Sandy Thaler, and I am an interviewer for the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. Today, I am interviewing Vicki Beer, Professor of Industrial Engineering and Engineering Physics in the University of Wisconsin-Madison College of Engineering. Good morning.
Hi.
We're going to start the questions by having you talk about your early life, where you were born, where you went to school, what was your family like, were there any people when you were a child that influenced you in your future education and career?
Sure. I was born in New York and grew up in Tucson, Arizona, and probably the biggest influence on my career in my early days was my dad. I was always interested in math and liked math, and I remember when I was like maybe kindergarten or first grade age, he used to sometimes give me math problems instead of bedtime stories when he put me to bed and, you know, teach me about negative numbers or things like that. And I liked that. And then later, as when I was older, like in high school, we actually used to fight a lot about that because he would help me with my math homework from school, but like usual, you know, the styles change, so he would do the problems a different way, and I would get very frustrated. We would yell at each other. So these days, I use much more math than probably my dad ever knew, but, you know, I think at some level, my choice of career was maybe inspired partially to prove to him that I could do it. Wasn't too dumb to do high school math properly, but.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
I have two younger brothers, one of whom went into business, is just starting a new company in Holland right now. And the other brother has been kind of off and on employed throughout his life, and these days more not. But
are
doing
your parents
okay.
Still living?
My dad is still alive, not my mom.
And what, were you in public school?
I went to public school for most of my education, except for a couple of years. When we moved to Arizona, right around the time of first grade, I guess it was probably the move was stressful, and I was sort of an anxious kid, and I was ahead of my age. I already knew how to read and things like that. So I was very bored in first grade, and then would, when I was bored and didn't have enough to do, would sit there and worry and, you know, wonder if my mother was going to forget to pick me up for some reason and cry and whatever. So at that point, they took me out of the public school and put me in a private school and moved me up to doing second grade work instead of first grade work. And so I did second, and so I basically skipped first grade and then did second and third grade in private school. And by fourth grade, I guess we were in a new neighborhood and they put me back in public school and it went a little better.
Was it a good public school system?
I would say so-so. Mm-hmm. Junior high was not particularly good, I thought. There was a lot of kind of rote work where you got graded off for, you know, forgetting to put the down in the United States of America and things like that. It was not very inspirational, but it was okay. I got a decent education.
And it was obvious from when you were very young that you would be going on to college?
Yeah, I think that was just kind of the expectation. My two brothers both went to college, and I think both have some graduate education as well. Mm-hmm. One an MBA and one a master's in journalism, I think. So, it was just kind of the norm. My dad was a PhD and my mom was college educated, so that was sort of the expectation.
So how was the decision made on where you were going to undergraduate school?
Oh, that's a complicated question. I don't really want to get into that one. But I ended up going to Stanford, which was a pretty good mix. I think my parents were worried about my going away to school, but at some level, I just knew I wanted to go. And I don't think it was necessarily a very carefully considered choice or done for the best reasons or with, you know, all of the best information. But it worked out very well for me. I think I was one of those kids who was always very studious and conscientious and, you know, stayed up late to finish my homework or whatever. And Stanford was the kind of place where you could get a good education, but the culture on campus was also that, you know, it was important to do things like play frisbee at lunch hour or go for long walks at the lake or go watch the sunset at the beach and that kind of thing. So I think I got a little more balanced approach to life during my college years, and I didn't need to be encouraged to work hard. I kind of needed to be encouraged to do other things too. So Stanford was a good choice for me compared to, I think, some of the Ivy League schools on the East Coast are a little more serious atmosphere that would not have been as good for me. So.
And how was your undergraduate education funded?
Well, that was kind of touch and go. I think, you know, one of the reasons my parents were worried about me going away is because they were just worried I was the oldest child and a daughter, and how was I going to cope, and was everything going to be okay? But the financial situation was also a little unclear, and we were pretty solidly middle class, but college is always expensive. And I think when I started, my dad said that he could not make a commitment for 4 full years because he really didn't know what the finances were going to be like through the years. And he kind of, in looking back on his career, has said that always he ended up with extra money just when he needed it. There would be some consulting project or business venture or something that would come along beside his regular research work for salary. So he never knew where the money was going to come from ahead of time, but he always kind of got lucky, and just when he knew he was going to need more, something would come along that would provide a little extra. So pretty much that's how I got through college, is my parents paid for most of it. I worked a little bit, but not a lot. And, you know, my dad just kind of lucked into some various things through the years. Mm-hmm. But I also am surprised when we can wait and just wait for it. Hopefully that'll call back. I also am surprised when I look at how kids go to school today with how much penny pinching I did. Like, I don't think I owned a stapler when I was in college, because, you know, that would be $5 at the bookstore or whatever it was, and that seemed like a lot of money for something that wasn't absolutely essential, and I could always just scrounge paper clips or fold over the corners of my pages. And you know, I didn't have a calculator when I was in school. Of course, at that time, they were still kind of new, and so a lot of people had slide rules or whatever instead. But I bought my first calculator after I graduated college, a very nice one as kind of my graduation present to myself. And now when I look at the kids who come to school with, you know, the laptop and the MP3 player and the, you know, everything, the cell phone and all that stuff, I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, I went to school with, you know, 2 suitcases full of clothes and a blanket, and that was about it. So it is a very different age, but so I contributed a little bit, mainly, I think, just by scrimping and saving. But.
And what your major was, math?
My major was mathematical sciences, which is basically applied math. We took less math than the serious math students. We didn't take topology and number theory and things like that. And instead we took, I guess, a year of statistics and then a couple of computer science classes and a couple of operations research classes, mathematical modeling. And that also was a pretty good fit, I think, for my interests.
Mm-hmm. And then did you go right on to earn your PhD?
I did. I think basically when I was graduating, I sort of didn't quite know what I wanted to do with myself, and the idea of finding a job was just sort of scary, and I knew how to go to school. I was good at that, so that was kind of the path of least resistance, was just to go on to graduate school. So.
And where was that?
At MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I guess that had some ups and downs to it, the grad school years. Basically, I think many students find the process of finding a thesis topic and work on a thesis, it's a very big change from
the earlier years where you're just doing, you know, one homework assignment after another, and there's constant feedback of, you know, every week you have a deadline and every week you get a grade, and suddenly you're just kind of thrown into the midst of it and you don't know if you're headed in a good direction or even making any progress at all for a long time. So that was kind of frustrating or depressing or whatever, but overall it worked out okay. So,
and you had good professors and...
I did. I actually had a couple of different advisors at different phases. My first advisor was somebody that was just not well suited to me at that stage of life. I think now I could work with him just fine, but now I'm much more confident. And he kind of expected that he could just sort of point a student in a direction and have them go and just do something. And I kind of felt like, well, I really wanted a lot more sanity check of whether I was doing the right thing, whether I was making sensible assumptions or whatever. And so I would ask, well, do you think it's a good idea for me to talk about this with this or that professor to get their advice about it? And he would say, oh, no, just go do it. Mm-hmm. And of course, now either I would have the confidence to just go do it, or I would figure, you know, heck, if he told me not to talk to those guys, I think I should talk to them. I'm just going to go talk to them. But at that time, I felt like I couldn't really do it his way, and I didn't have the confidence to do it my way. And so it wasn't really going very well for a while, and I quit and took a year off. And when I came back, was working with somebody else. I was actually his first doctoral student in quite a long while. He kind of had a big hiatus when he wasn't doing a lot of research and advising a lot of students. And he and I got along very well. I think he was probably a little nervous that I was going to get mad at him like I got mad at the other guy. But I was very appreciative that, you know, he was happy to talk to me about, you know, any questions I had and all of that kind of stuff. And the one day that I had really bad news to report because what I thought was going to be my topic turned out to have already been done, and so I was going to have to go back and rethink and find a different topic, I actually brought him cookies or something just to say, look, you know, it's okay. I'm not upset. I'm not going to go jump off a building over this. You know, it'll be okay. And so we both were, you know, we were very good friends, and he was supportive of me and vice versa, I think. He was Al Drake, who was pretty well known at MIT at that time, and was, in fact, he was very surprised when I threw a party to celebrate graduating. The cake said, thanks, Al, instead of congratulations, Vicki. And he was kind of blown away that, you know, on my party, I would say thanks to him. But I think he had a lot to do with why I finished and why I finished happily instead of miserably. So
what was the topic?
The topic was uncertainty analysis for fault trees. And fault trees are something that's used in risk analysis for nuclear power plants, for chemical facilities, things like that. It was actually a topic I kind of come up with during my year off working. And this was like, when was this? I guess this was not too long after Three Mile Island. So the whole issue of how do we know whether things are safe or not seemed like kind of a big topic in people's minds. And I think that was interesting to me, not that my own work and my thesis had much to do with the national debate about nuclear power, but I just felt like I was part of something bigger, part of something important. And, you know, I could read in the newspaper about, you know, the protests at Seabrook or whatever and feel like my work was somehow related to these big things I was reading about in the news, and I like that. So,
after you received your PhD, did you do postdoc work or did you go?
No, in my field, postdocs were not very common, and I looked at both academic jobs and industry jobs and ended up going to industry. Partially, I don't think I got any academic offers at that time, but I was also pretty selective and really only looked at, you know, a small number of schools that would have been at the very top of my list. and didn't have my heart set on going into academia. So I went to work at a company, at that time it was called Pickard, Lowe & Garrick. Since then it's changed names a couple of times. But that was sort of the premier company in my field of risk analysis at the time. And actually a lot of the methods that are used now in risk analysis were developed at that company, not in academia. It was a very practical field where the utility companies were paying to have these analyses done, and it was a new technology. So, you know, every time you did an analysis, there would have to be some new methods developed or new refinements added to get it to work out right. And so it was a very good place to work, very interesting and fun, very friendly environment.
Where is it?
In Southern California, Newport Beach.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of nervous about taking the job. I did have actually an offer for a postdoc with the Advisory Committee on Reactor Safeguards in Washington, D.C. And somehow the postdoc seemed, you know, safer. I wasn't as nervous about it, but it also didn't seem as exciting. And it seemed like, well, it was just going to postpone the decision of what I do when I grow up for another year or two. And if I had an exciting offer to go to some place that seemed like a lot of fun and doing good work, I may as well just get on with it. And so I went there, and I was very happy there. I was there 7 years, and it was just great. It was socially fun and a great atmosphere, and I learned a lot. And
but you left. Work. Why did you leave?
Well, I think the major reason I left was, there were two reasons. One is I had tried getting research money while I was at PLG and not been very successful, partially because I think the cost structure is different. The overhead is much higher in industry, so it's difficult for the funding agencies to support research there. And also they really have, as part of their mission, supporting research at the universities. Mm-hmm. So I think they give some preference to the universities as well. And so I think if I had been able to get my schedule to do half-time consulting and half-time research, I might have been happier with that rather than half-time teaching and half-time research. But I really wasn't going to be able to do that there. And also, some very close friends of mine at the company had moved away, and it kind of wasn't going to be quite the same atmosphere anymore. It was going to be a bit of an adjustment, and it just seemed like a good time to look elsewhere. So,
how did you make that search? How did you decide where to go, and where did you go?
Well, at that time, I really didn't know where I would fit in, partially because of having been out of school so long, which is not the typical path. And so I interviewed at every place I could think of, from, you know, the sort of lesser schools like San Jose State or whatever that didn't have a PhD program or a big graduate program, to Harvard Business School, and, you know, every place in between, because I really didn't have a good sense of what would be a good fit and where I would be competitive. And Wisconsin at that time, actually my boss was on the advisory committee for the engineering physics department here, and he knew they were looking for somebody in risk analysis, and he was sorry to lose me, but also knew that I was looking anyway, and he might lose me anyway, so he kind of said, well, they should talk to me. And so I came here once to interview in engineering physics, and pretty quickly during that day we mutually figured out that I was not going to be a good match for them full-time, because I'm not a physical scientist. I don't teach their kind of classes and stuff. And so they said, well, you know, I thought industrial engineering was also looking for people in a related area, and, you know, why don't I send you over to talk to them? And then I came back, I think, and had a second interview with IE. And it did turn out to be a very good match. I ended up having a visiting position at University of Maryland for a year before coming here. But basically, this was my first full-time academic job. And I really have liked being in the IE department here. First of all, I think in operations research, people are kind of equally likely to go to IE departments or to business schools. But in business schools, they kind of want you to be doing business applications, finance or marketing or something like that, which I just was not interested in. And here, the fact that I was working on risk of engineered systems, you know, made sense to people, even if they didn't have related interests. It seemed logical. And this department is also very eclectic and has a very wide range of people doing a wide range of things. So there's some IE departments, you know, there's some places where I actually turned down offers that were doing very much kind of all manufacturing related work, and I would have been kind of the one person out in left field doing something different. Whereas here, even if nobody else really was doing what I was doing, they were all just in a zillion different directions, and I was by no means the farthest out in left field compared to some of my colleagues. It was just all in the mix, and so it was a pretty good choice overall.
What year was that?
I guess I left PLG in 89, spent 89-90 at University of Maryland, although I already had accepted an offer to come here and was just on leave from here for that first year, and then came in fall 1990. Mm-hmm. I've been here pretty much ever since.
And did you come in as a assistant professor?
I did. I had some publications during my time in industry, but not a whole lot. And that was a little bit of a sore subject for a while. You know, some people were hired with not very much background, more than me as tenured associate professors or whatever. But it did mean that I got a little faster start on my tenure clock, took a year shorter to get tenure because I already kind of knew the ropes in some ways and had more of a reputation or whatever. Mm-hmm. So,
And the tenure process went smoothly?
Pretty much. It's nerve-wracking, but it all went okay. And that last year I had a little bit of a distraction because just when everything was coming for a vote was the year that I met my husband, so I took my mind off things a little bit. Yeah,
that's good.
Yeah.
Talk about the facilities in which you work. I know this is a new building.
Yeah, I moved into the Engineering Center's building, I guess about 2 years ago, maybe three, I forget, not long ago, because of renovations going on here on campus. The older building, mechanical engineering, you know, was really very old and historic and also a little bit decrepit or not quite the most modern facilities. Here, the offices are a lot smaller, but very efficient, very well laid out, good storage and everything. And they have great conference rooms and meeting space and all that kind of stuff, nice student labs. I think my only real gripe with the building is the floors on the first floor. They have these very artistic multicolored floor patterns, and it's a marvel that the technology exists that they can make those floors, but somehow if I was an artist and making floors, I'm not sure I would have made that one. It just has a little too much color and too many different shapes going on for my taste, so I'm not sure that it's great artwork for the ages, but other than that, that's my biggest gripe about the building, really. So
now, you mentioned a little bit earlier about the culture of the department. If you could talk a little bit more about that. Is there collaborative work that's encouraged?
Well, collaboration, the department likes collaboration, but it, at least as an assistant professor, it's very difficult because you're also judged on your independent contributions. So if you collaborate too much, it kind of can put you at risk. Mm-hmm. And for me, a lot of my collaborations have been with people at other schools just because I'm not kind of in the mainstream of what's done in the department. I've had a couple of collaborators within the department over the years. But the department also has a little bit of an odd culture in other ways. I see it especially because I'm in two different departments with engineering physics. And IE, one colleague years and years ago who has since left, and he probably forgot he ever said this, but he once described the culture to me as cordiality bordering on hostility. So everybody is very friendly and gets around and slaps each other on the back and whatever. But there's also a big streak of defensiveness. So if you ask a question about, you know, why do you think that's the best person to hire? Or, gee, you know, why do the different qualifying exams have such different pass rates, are the exams really fair or whatever. You know, it may be a perfectly honest question, just asking for information, not a criticism, but it's immediately interpreted as a criticism and kind of people getting defensive and lunging across the table. And how dare you imply that blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, compared to my other department, there really is not as much of a tradition of discussion on the merits and kind of asking the hard questions and really being willing to discuss openly what's the best thing to do. A lot of the decisions get made kind of behind closed doors, in a sense, or the old boys network, or, you know, usually by the time it's brought to a department meeting, it's pretty much known what the answer is going to be, and it's often kind of a rubber stamp. And in some ways, it's been getting away from that. The department does have retreats every year to try and, you know, think through some of the bigger questions about hiring and philosophy and, you know, what we want to be in 5 or 10 years and those kind of things. But it's pretty difficult to break through that established culture of how business gets done here. So that's been kind of a disappointment that I tend to be one of those people who likes asking those hard questions and, you know, how do we know that this is the best way to do things? You know, could we be doing better? Mm-hmm. And in other parts of my work life, people just think, oh, gee, you know, good question. Let's talk about that for a few minutes and see what we think. And here, often, even when I don't expect it, even when I think I'm just sort of stating the obvious or asking an obvious question, I regularly will have, you know, a dozen heads kind of pivoting around looking at me like, she dares to say that to us? It's like, oh, gee, I didn't realize I opened my mouth again when I shouldn't have, or, you know, didn't phrase things diplomatically. And I think other people in the department have a better fit to the culture. And even if they ask the same questions I do or raise the same concerns, somehow they manage to do it in a way where everybody just looks at them and says, oh, well, of course we agree with that. And when I say it, it just doesn't come out right. It comes out as an implied criticism or something. And I've never learned how to phrase it properly. And they just always give me these funny looks. So.
Doesn't stop you from asking.
Right. It hasn't stopped me from asking them. Partially, I think I'm just too naive to realize which questions are going to get me the funny looks. And I never did figure out the culture at that level to know what are people thinking when I ask something.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about teaching. Do you enjoy teaching?
Yes and no. I don't really enjoy lecturing very much. Partially because the material gets kind of boring after a while. You've given the same lecture and it's something you already know well. And partially, you know, a lecture to a big crowd of faces, you really don't know always what's going on with the students, where they're coming from, what they understand, what they don't understand. And so, you know, my favorite part of teaching is really working with students one-on-one, office hours or that kind of thing. And then even if the student is struggling and did not understand my lecture, usually when they come to office hours, you can see, oh yeah, here's the point they didn't understand. Now, if I give them this one piece of information or this one insight, then they can go away and do more, get farther, and, you know, it will fix where they're stuck. In lecture, it's hard to do that, so a lecture is kind of more frustrating. But lately, a few years ago, I participated in CCLE on campus, creating a collaborative learning environment. And I think that got me kind of loosened up a little bit to do some other things other than traditional lecture. So that's been more fun and more interesting.
How many students have you mentored?
I forget exactly. For PhD students, I think I probably had maybe 6 or 8 PhD graduates, roughly one every other year, probably since I've been here. Some of them who've done much better than others. And But there have been a lot of other students through the years, master students, PhD students who ended up working with somebody else, or even undergrads who worked with me on various things. But lately, the last few years, I'm much more heavily funded, and my work on Homeland Security is kind of a hot topic. I thought everything I was doing was fascinating and expected to have students beating down the door to work with me. But since I got the work on Homeland Security, I now have many more students working with me in different capacities, so it's a different environment. And I think nicer for the students. They have more interaction with each other, and it's less isolating to be part of a bigger group. So,
do you have to teach them how to write?
Oh, I don't know if I do it well either, but yes. I have some students actually who are very good writers, which is nice. But I am pretty picky and critical about writing, and so even the good students, the good writers, get back a lot of red marks on their papers, and some of the poorer ones get many, many drafts and iterations before they're done. I think it's complex because I have a lot of foreign students, especially from Asia or from the Middle East, and I don't know this, it's kind of my own speculation, but I think some of those cultures, people also get less practice writing their own original thoughts, even in their own language. There's more emphasis on kind of regurgitation or rote and, you know, citing what other famous people have written, and less on expressing your own ideas. So I don't know that some of them know how to write even in their own language. And then if you add on all the language difficulties, it really gets tough. But it has been a big problem. And I think because of that, I've also had some recurring struggles with plagiarism that seems to have gotten more prevalent the last few years, of students who plagiarized and then had to get incompletes and do their work again from scratch, and sometimes takes, you know, 5 or 6 drafts to get all the plagiarized text out of there. And so I don't know whether students really don't realize that it's wrong or just don't know what else to do. I do try to be generous the first time, especially with foreign students, and tell them that I don't know what the norms are in their culture, but in this country it is considered theft, to kind of give them the benefit of the doubt that, you know, they may not have known they were cheating or doing something wrong, but they better fix it. But it has been very frustrating, again, you know, more so it seems like in the last few years. Mm-hmm.
Would you talk about your research? Where did your research interests come from? What are the large questions that are explored in your research? How is it funded?
Yeah. Well, I've always been interested in uncertainty and basically how people make decisions in the face of uncertainty. In the early years coming out of consulting, a lot of the research questions I was working on were really questions that had come up in a way in my consulting practice, not necessarily that some client had ever asked me, you know, can you work on this for me, but kind of the niggling question in the back of your mind of, gee, there's a couple different ways to do this, and how do we know which one gives the right answer, or, you know, are they really the same or not, and things like that that you just don't have time to explore in consulting, that I had the opportunity to come back and really think about more rigorously when I was back in academia and get answers to some of them. So I think for a long time I was really kind of mining the interest that I had developed in consulting. Then starting actually before September 11th, I had a couple of colleagues here on campus, Larry Bank and Steve Robinson, who both had projects or proposals underway related to security, and asked me to be involved because of my risk background. And at the time, they had the foresight to realize that this was going to be a problem. I did not. I thought, well, this is a fun thing to think about, but it's kind of a waste of time, really, because it's not that important. And of course, then, you know, not too much later, we had September 11th. And so since then, I think the big question that I've been dealing with is, in what ways is security different from safety, from the kind of risk analysis I had done before for accidents or natural disasters or whatever? And the big difference, of course, is that the threat is intentional and can observe what we've done and modify their strategy accordingly and so forth. And so that's been very interesting to me. It's given me a lot of new things to think about. And I went back and learned some game theory to be able to account for those interactions and made my students learn a lot more in game theory. I think I'm getting too old to learn new tricks maybe, but so that's been very interesting to me the last several years.
And how is it funded?
These days I am funded exclusively right now from Department of Homeland Security. They have several different centers of excellence around the country, and we don't have one here at Wisconsin, although we did apply for one, but I have sort of modest amounts of funding from three different centers. And earlier on, I did have some NSF funding in this area, and Steve Robinson had a big grant from the Army Research Office, so those kind of let me get my feet wet so that I was sort of ready when DHS came along and was looking for researchers in this area. So it worked out pretty well.
Have you had leaves over the years, sabbaticals, to work on
research? I had one sabbatical, which is, I forget exactly what year it was, around 2001 or two maybe, where I didn't go anyplace because of my family situation, but I did spend a lot of time in the econ department over here, sitting in on some classes in economics and game theory, and getting to know especially one faculty member over there, Larry Samuelson, pretty well, and had a very fruitful collaboration with him and one of his students for a while. And so it really turned out to be perfect timing, because I don't think I knew at the time that I set up the sabbatical that I was going to be doing nothing but game theory for security for the next 5 years, but it worked out to be perfect timing to get that background and go on and do something pretty different from what I had done before.
This is really switching directions now. Would you talk about the climate for women here? You're in a field that is predominantly male, I'm assuming, and it continues to be.
Yeah.
Does it help or hinder the participation and advancement of women?
Well, I think the climate is very mixed, and there's a lot of kind of microclimates that people talk about. First of all, this department, the climate for women has changed a lot through the years, depending who was chair, and some people have really seen it as their mission to kind of look out for women and minorities and assistant professors, and other people kind of have felt like, well, what's the big deal? Why are their needs any different?
Yep.
Whatever. So that's been kind of frustrating to see, you know, what had been a pretty good climate regress for a while and have to struggle back to educate a new chair about why those issues were important or, you know, what needed to be done. I'm fortunate in one way, which is that IE has a pretty big percentage of women on the faculty compared to some of the other departments where if you're the only one, it can be a lot more isolating. But also, when I first joined here as an assistant professor, at that time, Denise Denton was on the faculty here also as an assistant professor. And she was very active in getting women together from around the engineering school, from around campus, women who were in untraditional fields where they did feel isolated. I think Denise knew that, you know, she needed that support for herself, but she also knew that, you know, it ought to work for everybody. And, you know, whatever she did for herself could be a benefit to other people also. And so there's a kind of irregular lunch group of women that used to meet a little more regularly. Now it's kind of more occasional, but there's been, you know, an email mailing list for lunches and meeting, you know, every 2 weeks, every 4 weeks, whatever, as time goes by. So that if you have a problem in your department or just a really frustrating week or whatever, you know, you can go and you know, cry on somebody's shoulder or get advice, you know, here's what you should say to that jerk chair of yours who told you this stupid thing or whatever. And so that's been very helpful also, because even if this department has more women, it's still, you know, first of all, it's different talking to people in your own department, and it's still not quite kind of a critical mass in a way. And to have a group that you can go to every few weeks and just feel like, okay, this is some place where you can let your hair down and just air your gripes or just laugh about, you know, the dumb things that happen to you or whatever. So that's been really important, I think, both for the people that are more isolated, that are the only women in their department or have had a really big struggle, and just makes life nicer for everybody. Sure. So,
now, are you seeing more women students, undergrads?
Not really. Engineering as a whole has been kind of plateaued for many, many years. Mm. 15 years or more, I don't know. It's been a long time that nationally engineering has about 18% women and has never really gotten much above 20%. IE is, again, kind of one of the more popular fields for women. So our undergrads, we have, I would say, at least a third women, which is really very nice for the students and nice for me to stand up there and see, you know, a variety of different faces. It's not all guys. And I remember when I went to grad school how that it was kind of a creepy feeling if you walk into this room of, you know, 50 people and you're the only woman, and you're kind of sitting off in the corner wondering if everybody's looking at you or hoping nobody notices you or whatever, and everybody kind of talks past you over your head. And so I think for the undergraduates, it is really a nice atmosphere to have more women. And then, you know, they're not always the only woman on their project team or things like that. I think it's much healthier. But some of the other departments on campus, like electrical engineering, and some of them still have very, very low percentage women. And like I said, it rose really steeply for a while with the women's movement and more people going into these untraditional fields, and since then has been flat for a very, very long time.
So that's interesting.
Yeah.
Would you talk about the professional organizations that you're involved in and the extent of your involvement?
Yeah. I'm involved in two major societies, INFORMS, which stands for the Institute for Operations Research and Management Science, and the Society for Risk Analysis. And within INFORMS is one of those huge societies with, you know, thousands and thousands of members. But within that, there's a group called the Decision Analysis Society, which is kind of my little home in INFORMS and the more congenial group that shares a lot of my interests and whatever. And I've been reasonably active in both of those. I've been officers, you know, on the governing council for the national organizations. I was an associate editor for a number of years for the Journal of Risk Analysis. And actually, for quite some time, the Society for Risk Analysis has been asking me to run for president of the National Society. And so far, I haven't done it in many years. I think as an assistant professor, I felt like it wasn't really appropriate. And now with kids, I feel like, well, I shouldn't really be signing on for things that are going to involve more travel. And so it just has not risen to the top of my priority list. But I guess I'm likely to do it someday.
Yeah. Do you have to do a lot of traveling for your position?
A fair amount. It kind of averages to a trip a month, probably. Mm-hmm. Maybe every 6 weeks, but more like a trip a month, I think. And I used to really enjoy traveling. Now that I have kids, I just, you know, if I get a period of 2-3 months with no trips, I'm just delighted and look at the calendar and breathe a sigh of relief. But so I do a fair bit, but not nearly as much as some people do. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, that statement leads us right into the last question.
Yeah.
If you would talk about your family and how you balance work and family.
Yeah. Well, I have, my husband Dave is a PhD economist who's working in a consulting firm here in town. These days he's actually working only half-time, but for many years he was working full-time. And I have two kids, Katie, who's 10, who came the old-fashioned way, and Daniel is almost 4 and was adopted from Guatemala, because I was getting too old to do it the old-fashioned way, I think. So we're pretty busy and keeping up with, you know, two demanding careers and two demanding high-maintenance kids. Katie's a little more high-maintenance than Daniel, I think. But So we keep busy with that, but it's been a lot of fun, of course, too, and very gratifying. And I think my main pieces of advice for people on how to balance work and family, the first one is that you don't do much else. And, you know, I'm either at home with the kids or working, and I don't have a lot of hobbies or nights out with the girls or anything like that. It's pretty much just home and work and home and work and home and work. But the other thing is to find ways that what I want to do for myself also fits into my family life. So I haven't done a lot of volunteer work since I've had kids, but what I've done has mostly been at my daughter's daycare. I like to plant a garden every year, a vegetable garden, and I don't spend a lot of time gardening, but I figure it's good for the kids to, you know, get to help plant and get to pick the tomatoes, even if they don't like to eat them or whatever, pick the green beans. And so things like that, that sort of do double duty, that are, you know, fun for the kids and fun for me too. And, you know, a lot of times I get my exercise in while Katie is at her gymnastics practice, and I'll drop her off and run to the gym and come back and things like that. So you kind of have to find ways to squeeze things in. But
where does your father live?
He lives in Arizona, and my husband's parents live in California. And most of our vacation time is spent taking our kids to visit their grandparents. So we spend a lot of time with Dave's mom in Southern California and with my dad. And it's geographically desirable. We get to go someplace warm every winter. And I think it also has just been important to us, especially since our parents are older, they're all in their 80s, that we want our kids to have as much time with their grandparents while they can, that it's not going to last forever. So we don't do a lot of, you know, exotic vacations of, oh, let's take the kids to Club Med or to wherever, you know, figure, okay, time to go visit Grandma and Grandpa again.
That's nice. End of the interview.
Okay.
And I really appreciate this. This was an excellent interview. Thank you for your time, and best of luck in your career.
Thank you.
You're doing so many important things.
Well, and I hope this is useful and interesting to somebody someday. So
it is, I'm sure. Thank you.
Okay, great.